This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock on Monday, the 13th of August. I'm Melissa Idris, and I'll be keeping you company all the way till 10 o'clock. With me in the studio is Kusu Chuang and Joyce Goh, my favorite Penangites ever.
Good morning.
Yeah, well, your favorite Penangite presenters on air with you in the morning.
Right now. That narrows the universe a little bit. Right?
Hey, it's a Penang show today.
It is a Penang show.
Yeah, all Penangites. On air.
We were taking over the studio, taking over the world, I tell you.
So
how was your weekend, guys?
Way too short, clearly.
It was great. It was great. Good catch up with family and friends. The usual, try and make up, stretch the weekend as long as we can. But you know, like everything that's good, it has to come to an end eventually.
Right.
So yeah, here we are.
Don't worry, I'll be here soon enough. Yeah. Just around the corner. Mm. Well, if you hadn't been plugged in over the weekend, let us catch you up on all the news that happened. In fact, one piece of news that had been dominating headlines over the weekend was the Seattle-Tacoma plane theft. On Saturday, a man had stolen an empty passenger plane from Seattle Airport, and he took it to the air, forcing the airport to close, and then two fighter jets to give chase to the plane. So apparently he did some kind of Top Gun moves while in air. I think he did a roll and then went really close to the water surface of the lake, and he couldn't land the plane, unfortunately crashed it and was killed during the crash. And up to a few hours ago, guys, he was unnamed. But the U.S. media have now named him as Richard Russell, a 29-year-old airline worker with full credentials. And apparently he had worked at the airport for more than 3 years. So he had all these, he had the clearances, and he had been, I think, towing the planes and dealing with passenger bags. And one day just decided to, you know, take a risk. And unfortunately, he lost his life for it.
Incredible. You know, this is not a demonstration plane. It's not a show plane. It's a 76-seat twin-engine turboprop Bombardier, right?
It's a passenger plane,
It's a full-on passenger plane.
It is.
And what on earth could have compelled him to do this?
Well, he was apparently depressed. And I don't know why. I think they're still trying to think about motives as to why he decided to do that. But it came as a bit of a surprise to his family and friends.
Yeah, bit of a surprise. Tell you what. Oh, by the way, your husband just, you know,
of all things to do, right? Yeah.
But he's taken the plane and gone and did a few loop-de-loops.
But what was interesting is that he had no training. Apparently in his communication to the air traffic control, they asked him, okay, do you need help to land the plane? And he said, no, don't worry, I've played video games before.
What?
Yeah, that's exactly what he said.
He actually
had no kind of aviation training and managed to do these really complicated maneuvers.
And to get it on air, to take off.
Yeah.
But you must, can you imagine how scared the Americans must be, you know, to get a plane?
Oh, for sure. Imagine it just lands in your neighborhood, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but also for me is the flashback to what happened to the Twin Towers.
9/11,
right.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think there's a lot of still kind of lingering emotion there. But still in the US, NASA, the space agency, has launched a mission to send a satellite closer to the sun than ever before. The Parker Solar Probe rocket lifted off from Cape Canaveral in Florida. And this is going to be, hopefully, helping us crack some of the long-standing mysteries of the sun. It's going to fly as close to the sun's surface as possible, trying to find out where the sun gets its heat from, essentially.
Yeah, so close in these terms is 6.12 million square kilometers.
Well, can't get close enough,
right?
Then it might just fizzle
just
into nothing.
Yeah.
That's really close. That's the closest ever, that's what you're saying.
So the analogy is that if the Earth and the sun were a meter apart, this would be 4 centimeters from the surface.
Yeah, so, that's right. We'll put it into ratio. Very good.
Yeah.
And a Chinese tourist has died after being bitten in the chest by a hippo he was trying to photograph in Kenya. You know, when I read this story, guys, I forget sometimes that the hippo is the world's most deadliest animal.
Yeah.
I forget that.
That's right. It kills 500 people a year. It's 3 tons and it's got really sharp teeth. What is most disconcerting about this story is the fact that his name was Chang Ming Chuang.
Chuang.
Yes.
He feels a kinship already. Don't be taking photos with any wild animals.
Don't get too close. That's how it happened.
All right. In just a few minutes, we're going to take a look at what makes for a good arrival at an airport. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Red Hot Chili Peppers there with Aeroplane. 6:10 right now, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Goh and Kusu Chuang this morning. And Chuang has just come back from KK over the weekend.
That's
haven't you,
right.
Chuang?
That's right.
Well, why I pointed that out is because apparently there are buskers as in the arrivals hall at Kota Kinabalu International Airport, and according to the Deputy Chief Minister of Sabah, she has received, Christina Liu that is, has received many complaints from visitors, both local and internationally, about the buskers at the arrival hall, claiming that these buskers are too noisy and create for an unwelcoming environment.
Yeah, first of all, I want to say that the KK Airport is actually really good. It actually resembles KLIA, but on a smaller scale, and they come out. There's actually the arrivals hall, it's actually in the area where you wait for your cars to pick you up, your taxi arrivals or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's where they set up. And I thought they were pretty good because I walked out and what can only be described as indigenous music, right?
It's the buskers, good.
Yeah,
mean, okay.
Yeah, and they're playing good stuff. It was really loud though. I was not on a Grab phone because I'll be getting picked up, but you know, on a phone call to a Grab driver. But I thought it was pretty good. But they are a loud bunch.
The loud one. Okay. So I guess that got us asking: what makes for a good environment, right? What do you want to arrive to when you come to an arrival hall, Joyce?
Well, for me, it's more of just to minimize the time that you have to wait, like just get
for bags.
And you just want to get going. You know, you just get bags, go immigration, and you just want to get home as soon as possible. And in this case, if you're waiting for a cab, that's fine. But if you need to call for the cab and all that, and if the music is affecting the call, then perhaps not such a good idea. I don't know. Or could they go somewhere else, or maybe play less, lower?
Well, the idea for buskers is to give access to foot traffic, right? That's what buskers are for. They go where there's a lot of foot traffic. You know, Central Market is an idea.
For example.
Well, and also to give a flavor, a local flavor to international tourists. Mm. But can I just say, I'm with you, Chuang. I recently arrived at KLIA too, and there were buskers playing. And while they were good, they were very loud. And you're coming up from a long flight, or maybe not long, but delayed. And you're picking up your bags, you're walking through immigration and the long lines there. And the last thing you want is more chaos in your brain, right? You just want kind of tranquil, zen environment.
Well, then what happens then if you go to a tube station or, you know, MRT stations haven't really been hit by the busker bug yet. But in London, most of the stations there are, you know,
every
populated
corner
by buskers, right? And imagine after a long day, you want to go home to some serenity and then you're bombarded, your oral senses, by these buskers.
I don't think
the London, you know, government or whatever, the mayor, mm-hmm, has outlawed buskers.
No,
it's part
not
of
at
the
all.
Fabric of the London
yeah,
society.
Yeah, it is.
Right?
It is. It's part of, you're exactly right. It's part of the cacophony of sounds of the London tube, right?
But the idea,
I think, also is, you know, it's what we expect. So perhaps when we come to an arrival hall, what do we expect? We expect order. So much like what you're saying, Joyce, we want things to be done orderly and efficiently. So if that's orderly and if everything's done, you know, according to a certain schedule and you know the process and you're getting your bags on time, you're breezing through immigration, then perhaps I think the environment becomes a little bit, you're a little bit more, I guess,
less stressed.
And, you know, you can forgive small irritances like loud music.
Well, the perfect arrival would be like on a fantasy island where you're greeted by cocktails, flower garlands, a 3 foot tall midget in a tuxedo named Tattoo, for example, on a sea aeroplane, right?
Right.
Well, then,
it's a real show, by the way, in case you guys.
We know fantasy
well,
island,
might, but you know, well, I don't know.
It's a different generation. You're showing your age here.
That's right.
well, this busking corners. I mean, it was introduced in Sabah in 2015. This is to encourage local talent to showcase their works. And they were allowed to perform designated areas from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. daily, subject to guidelines issued by City Hall.
Wow, that's a long time.
I think that's great. I think it should be encouraged.
Well, you know, for me, I don't really mind buskers if they're going to, you know, it's how they make a living anyway. But what I do want are clean toilets. That's all I ask. An arrival hall, please have clean toilets. toilets, because you come off the plane, you're dying to use the loo, and all you want is for the toilets to be clean and dry.
Imagine you just come from Japan.
Yeah. with seat warmers and music bidets and all that. Tell us what you think. We'd love to hear from you. What makes a good arrival haul? WhatsApp number 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got a look at the so-called syntaxes after this. Do they work? We'll discuss next on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:21 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run. Melissa, Joyce and Chuang here with you. That was Evil Friends by Portugal, The Man. And speaking about The Man, governments around the world, they're using syntaxes.
What a name, yeah.
They're using syntaxes, and I'm using syntaxes in air quotes. You can't see me, but I am using my fingers to say syntaxes to dissuade people from doing everything from smoking to drinking alcohol to gambling. And in recent years, we also have some lawmakers that have turned their crosshairs to a different type of vice, sugar. So according to research, obesity is on the rise across the world. And apparently 40% of Americans today are obese. That's compared to the 15% just about 40 years ago. So you've got some countries around the world now implementing a tax on sugary drinks. And this has fallen under what they call a sin tax. So the question is, and this was posed by the latest issue of The Economist, do sin taxes work? And are syntaxes fair? Because they're two different questions, right?
The answer is it depends on who you ask, right? If you ask the government whether syntaxes work, then they'll say yes, because they accumulate revenue for the government. And, you know, the two brewers in Malaysia, I've got the Heineken Berhad annual report in front of me, 1.2 billion ringgit is what they've contributed to the government in excise taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you ask the government, does it work?
What in terms of revenue?
If their prime mandate is to accumulate revenue, then the answer is yes. If their prime mandate is to stop people drinking, then they have failed, right? So it depends on what the mandate is.
Yeah, true. And also whether or not these sin taxes are fair to consumers, because, you know, people can have occasional drinks, they're not really alcoholics, but they're taxed no differently from the alcoholics, like the serious alcoholics.
What about tobacco?
Look, if the government was serious about outlawing people, stopping people from smoking, they'd just outlaw cigarettes, you know, right? They'll just say, look, there should be no tobacco products in the country, no cigarettes sold in Malaysia, and period. Right?
But, you know, okay, so that feels like it's a little, you know, one end of the spectrum. So here the government's saying, well, we're going to give you a choice, right? You're an individual, you can choose what to do with your life. But because if you fall sick, that could be a cost to the government terms of healthcare. And also, on another hand, well, let's get some revenue off you if you're
Right.
Let's make it harder for you or more difficult for you to for this vice in the eyes of the government. Then for them, the syntax would work, right?
Mm.
But the idea is whether it's effective in stopping people from smoking and from gambling and from drinking alcohol.
Well, the answer is no, isn't it?
They're all addictive. Is that the question?
It's addictive. It's enjoyable. It's a bit of a social, lubricants, for example.
Yeah, and also if they turn to the illegal like contraband cigarette. There's over 50% over 50% in the market already that people are there, they're buying that, and that's going to impact their health as well. Because how healthy, we're not even sure what they put into those.
Sure.
Well, smoking in general is not healthy.
Yeah, but what else is in these kind of illicit cigarettes? However, what about sugar though? So sugar fall under a sin tax, because if you look at research, it says that while obese people probably do present net cost to the government, smokers tend to die earlier, meaning they probably save the government money since they draw less from state pensions. And this is looking at countries who do provide kind of social health care.
Well, this whole issue of a fat tax, right? Remember, it was a fat tax. That's what it's called. And I think they were trying to introduce it in Japan, parts of Europe as well. And it's precisely because of these reasons that, you know, there were costs of the system to the health care. And there were health problems. And I'm not sure how far that went, but for Malaysia to be considering this, it's pretty apt because, I mean, we've got one of the highest obesity rates in Asia.
In
right?
Southeast Asia, yeah. But do you think it falls under a sin tax category? What do you think, Joyce?
Well, it could be if you just want to... for health reasons in a way, and
to discourage
you're
people.
Addicted to sugar and all that, and also you're saying that obesity, but also diabetes.
That's
right. Malaysia, yeah.
A quick mention from we've got a WhatsApp from Anonymous. Please tell us your name so we can credit you on air. So he or she said toilets the number one priority at any arrival location. For him or her, it would reflect the culture of the community. I couldn't.
Are you listening?
Agree
the
command
is the man listening.
All right, we've got the 6:30 news bulletin coming up after this. But first, here's "Walk Like a Man" from Grand Funk Railroad on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. It's My Life by The Animals. Hello and good morning. It's 6:40 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Goh and Kusi Chuang this morning. Thank you everyone for your WhatsApp messages and your tweets this morning. We were talking about what makes a good arrival haul at an airport, and a WhatsApp message from Ro on the on arrivals, and he said when he arrived at LAX, he received a few wolf whistles from the Latina ladies in the waiting area. It took him back a bit, he said, but he had to admit that it felt kind of good.
Which then prompted a few click-throughs to see what Ro looks like, but no avail.
Equal opportunity sexual harassment. That is sexual harassment, I might add, so we don't condone that. Right. Well, tell us what you think. Join our conversation at any point in time. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have a comment by Singapore's Emeritus Senior Minister Goh Chok Tong. I guess making a little bit of waves on social media. So he has sounded a warning that cabinet ministers in Singapore are not paid enough, and that down the road, Singapore will be confronted with a problem of getting competent people to join the government.
For him to say that, I don't know, if Singapore ministers are not earning enough, what more in Malaysia, right?
Exactly.
I think the Prime Minister makes 25,000 ringgit a month, which is, I think he's the top earner.
25,000
ringgit a month, okay. Something like that.
And then everyone else is below that. So in Singapore, apparently, Joyce, so the reason why Goh Chok Tong made this comment is because there was an MP in Singapore, Edwin Tong. He was a lawyer. And apparently he took a 75% pay cut to when he became senior minister in July. So 75% is significant.
Yeah, so apparently Mr. Tong, he had previously earned more than 2 million Sing dollars a year as a senior counsel, and now makes about 500,000 Sing dollars. That's what Mr. Goh is saying, you know. So 500,000 per year works out to about, what, 40,000 per month.
Okay, first of all, would you take a 75% pay cut to do anything? Anything your heart desires.
You're asking Penang people, you know.
Yeah, actually, I've got a room full of Penangites. Yeah,
what this fella, Joyce Goh, that's why she's like...
Well, I did kind of take a pay cut. In a way, but it must come with some,
like, other benefits.
Yeah,
right.
Like maybe the afternoon with my kids. Then yes, you know.
This is public service.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
You know?
So.
So the answer really is it depends, right? Because if you're of that want and you've really made enough money in the private sector, then yeah, for sure, right? For example, say Tony Poh. I think Tony Poh was an entrepreneur in the past. He made some money. He cashed up his business, Cyber Village, or something. He's made a few million, and then now he can afford to go and serve the people because in the government service,
it's a public.
Service.
But shouldn't ministers be paid comparable to the private sector? Because
so
I have to say,
corrupt.
You pay peanuts, you get monkeys.
That's true. And this is what Goh Chok Tong is saying. He's saying, what if ministers are not paid well, very, very mediocre people will be ministers in the long run. He said, think about it. Is it good for you or is it worse for us in the end?
So some years ago, I was about to write a column for an esteemed financial publication. And I did a comparison between the cabinets, the respective cabinets of Singapore, Malaysia, and I compared the academic qualifications of both respective cabinets.
And what did you find?
I found on one side mediocrity, on the other side excellence. And I submitted the column, to which it was denied publication because it just showed the Malaysian government in a very poor light. this is about two, three years ago.
This is not okay. The Edge then? Cause
no, it is. It's a Malaysian weekly financial publication. I'm not going to say which name it was.
Right, okay. No, so what was the idea of putting that comparative?
I wanted to show that basically mediocre people, or in the words of Lee Kuan Yew, duds, entered the Malaysian civil service because there was just a very low barrier of entry and very poor expectations.
Well, maybe
versus
that's
the Singapore government, which boasted a whole bunch of Oxbridge graduates, for example. Mm.
They pick the kind of cream of the crop.
The best.
Yeah.
All right. So,
is it because of salary? Perhaps we're not enticing the best minds to join public service.
You pay peanuts, you get monkeys.
Actually, yeah, I believe in that. It does. You get what you pay for. That's another way to say it, right? You get what you pay for. And I must admit, I was at a work trip a couple of years ago with corporate people. I was covering the event. So we went to Singapore and we got to meet a couple of the ministers there. And I was blown away, man. Yeah. I mean, I met one of them. This was a deputy prime minister then, Teo Chee Hien. And he said, okay, ask me whatever questions you want. He had two PAs next to him taking notes. He had nothing, no notes, nothing in front of him. He's like, okay, ask me whatever you want. The corporate people, they were asking all sorts of questions, business questions, policy questions, numbers, stats. He could rattle it off just at the top of his head.
He knew his stuff.
Yeah, I was impressed.
By contrast, a few years ago when I was still reporting, I went to a press conference by the then domestic trade minister. I'm not going to say his name, okay, because it cast him in a bad light. One of the reporters asked that person about counterfeiting illegal CDs, back in the day, intellectual property infringements. You know what he answered? I like listening to Mariah Carey. If I like Mariah Carey, I will just listen to any way I want because it's just freely available. That was his answer. I was blown away. I said, what? This fellow, cabinet minister.
With the new Pakatan Harapan government, when they first came in, there was talk about cutting ministers' salaries, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's the right move.
So, the idea is if the whole country tightens their belt, the ministers should tighten their belts too.
Yeah, but then, not everybody's Tony Poala,
Yeah,
right?
That's
not
true.
Not everybody comes from having had a successful business.
Or comes from a rich family.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
right.
Tell us what you think. Should ministers' salaries be comparable to that of the private sector? We'd love to hear from you. After this, we're going to be looking at news that Johor is going to allocate 14 million ringgit for free marriage courses in the state. Is that a good idea? We'll discuss next on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Cheap Trick. If you want my love, right here on BFM 89.9. I'm Melissa Idris with Joyce Go and Kusu Chuang this morning. Speaking of cheap tricks, is it a cheap trick not to be paying ministers comparable to the private sector? Lots of people weighing in on this morning. Mr. Tan says, on quality of our ministers, I can't forget how we Malaysia banned the Power Rangers due to the word morphine. Now, this was communicated on a world stage.
Exactly,
so perhaps some of the comments coming out of the ministers may not show that they are worthy of a private sector salary. Yeah. What do you guys think?
Well, yeah, and that this is why you need to up the pay in a way so that you get the quality ones. I mean, Jerry was stepped in on cabinet ministers and says, yes, should be paid for performance for sure. Pay peanuts and get third raters. And the best should be, it's getting the best. That should be a criteria, looking at merit.
And we have Hiswani Hassan weighing in saying on Twitter, he said he took a 15% pay cut 18 years ago to serve in the public sector. He served for 10 years and would have lost out in bonuses and all that, but the experience he had was valuable, and he would like to think that he would have had the opportunity to serve the country.
Yeah, I think there's a certain cadre of society who have that public sector quotient in their makeup, and not everybody. some not within this room, clearly.
Sure, But Ishar Yusuf also says that the qualifications need to match that of the private sector. So he says that the reason could be, there are some people that still have those questionable degrees, which is a valid point.
Yeah, I mean, even Richard Lee, Lee Ka Shing's son, some years ago, I remember his Stanford degree was under question. And in fact, it turned out that he didn't have a degree from Stanford.
Richard Lee.
Yeah.
All right, well, tell us what you think. We'd love to hear from you. Again, our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Radio. Thank you for joining the conversation this morning. But we're also looking at news down south in Johor, where the Johor government has allocated 1.4 million ringgit. That's 14.4 million ringgit. And this is to provide incentives for free courses on marriage to benefit 12,000 couples who want to tie the knot in the state. So first of all, should the government be paying for marriage courses? I mean, is this something we want the state getting involved in for marriage courses?
Well, yeah, it depends on well, also another question is whether or not there's a need for marriage courses. And in this case, it looks like the Johor government thinks that there is. It's going to benefit 12,000 couples who want to tie the knot. Maybe for some, they would like to attend a course, but they don't know where to go to or they cannot afford it. So, yeah.
Have you guys ever attended
a marriage? No, man. I just rocked up at the temple, signed a couple things, answered yes to a couple questions, and that was it. But Bob's my uncle.
Bob's your uncle. I mean, and you have a wife.
I do. And it's been 10 years and I'm still stuck at the hip. So, best of all worlds.
Well, I have attended a marriage course. Okay. And I found it informative. I thought that was... Yeah, this was 12 years
what
ago.
What did you learn, Joyce?
They teach you things like financial planning together.
Oh,
like being
good.
Honest.
That's good.
Not financial planning, but just being honest with... You know how some... Maybe some people have credit card debts or they have some loans that they haven't... maybe they were shy to share it with their future spouse or you know. So it's like being honest with each other, communication, you know, things like that. But I don't know. They didn't teach... They didn't share information on how you would not get enough sleep after you have kids, though. I think they should include that.
That's a big element.
I think, should, right?
Sure.
Like, just prep you when you have kids, right?
Yeah, for sure. But the purist in me says that one should not be attending a course to get married because, you know, you like her, she likes you want to get together and stay together for the rest of your life, and off you go.
Why would
you have to attend a course?
Why not? Why? You have to attend a course to get a degree to get a job. Why shouldn't you attend a course to get a certification to enter the most sacred of unions?
Well, philosophically, I find it a bit strange that the government has to step in and provide free online, well, free courses to advise me on getting married.
I agree with that.
Right? If I want to sign up, I'll sign up to a private sector course and, you know, off I go. But why should the government be stepping in?
Mm.
Secondly, if I was offering a course, the first thing I'd tell the young prospective couple is that it's not about the wedding. It's not about how much glitz and glamour it is. It's not about the Instagram or the wedding planner. It's about you and the other person staying together for the long term. Whatever you do, don't get married and then ditch it within 3 years in.
Yeah, and how it's like a partnership, right?
Yes,
you're
right.
In it together. It's teamwork.
I love that both of you guys are such romantic. Like,
really?
Pragmatic. It's you versus you guys and the kids, you know? So
no, what you see, these opinions are skewed because we're Penang people. Penang people are very pragmatic creatures.
No, but I think it's good to go for the courses because it's informative in a way. It just kind of preps you. There's no like you pass or you fail, though. So that's great. It's just informative.
What if you fail?
Then you can't pass or fail. I don't think
well, tell us what you think. Have you attended a marriage course? And if you think marriage courses are effective, we'd love to hear from you. But we've got Alabama Shakes taking you all the way up to the 7 o'clock news bulletin with I Found You right here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.